Welcome back, the Rhetoric Warriors podcast, where we are tracking the rhetoric storms, linguistic meteorologists. That's what I'm going with today. There's a cold front rising from the east. We need to track that sucker. It's complicated times out there, requires sophisticated techniques. So let's learn some rhetoric. That's good stuff. I'm Dr. Dan, rhetorician, late night comedy writer, and founder of Rhetoric Warriors, new book out, 21 Colosseums of Persuasion. Check that. It will give you the master list of how to persuade others. The podcast, we talk to comedians about their careers and their politics, and I uncensor them, let them do the bits they can't do in clubs because they don't want to deal with all the blowback. That's fun. I convert conservatives on here. I bring them on here and talk them to a better position because the right fascinates and worries me. And I talk to persuasion pros and rhetoricians and all forms of message manipulators sending messaging out into the world. This podcast has more rhetoricians than any other podcast you're going to hear today. I'm going to stand by that claim. My message, or my guest today is a message pro, I guess is where I'll put him. He's done a lot of stuff. I've known this guy for quite a while, and he works in the comic arts, the comic strip Over the Hedge. That became a film, massive, interesting thing there with DreamWorks. He writes, illustrates books. Y'all remember books, right? In the YA genre? Are they YA?
No, middle grade.
Middle grade. Including The Odd Squad, How to Be a Supervillain, The Naughty List, and Ghosted, which I haven't heard about yet. So all sorts of interesting stuff out there. Michael Fry.
What's up? Howdy. Yeah. Thanks for having me. Yeah, this is fun.
Yeah.
I'm actually talking to somebody after, 15, 16 months, you know
I guess because, like, Austin and, I mean, I got vaxxed back in April, I guess.
Yeah,
and too. It feels like it's done, but it's not done.
Oh, no, it's not done. I was just watching the news. Did you hear what happened in Massachusetts?
No, I thought they were completely...
No. This came out of that CDC thing that just happened. Washington Post published a bunch of these, you know, secret emails or whatever. Well, it turns out that I don't know what city in Massachusetts, but it's like 70% in this one town of people who had already been vaccinated, came down with COVID. 70%.
70%?
Yeah, that's like a lot. And now they're saying, even if you're vaccinated, that you can spread the virus to other people just as easily as the unvaccinated people, which I'm not sure I believe that. But anyway, the bottom line, though.
The bottom line.
I'm making it sound like I'm some anti-vax nut, which I'm not. You still need to get vaccinated, please, because it still protects you from getting seriously sick and dying.
It's fascinating, though. Like, I have a guy that I've had on the podcast, and I'm trying to get him back on because he's so out there. He's an anti-vaxxer, and worked in alternative health forever. And a lot of those people, because they're used to going after the health officials and the people in charge anyway, they're easily manipulated over into applying that to conspiracy stuff. It's like their compass is easily turned. Like, yeah, I still totally get it. You're still rebelling. You don't trust, but now you're trusting not trusting the trustable people.
Right. You know?
And that's a problem.
Yeah, like, you can't make some kind of fine distinction between, you know,
anybody in power,
educated person who might know what they're talking about and someone who's just ganking your chain to make money.
Yeah.
You know, which a lot of these guys online are doing. And I think those people, they want to be steered around.
A lot of the stuff, and this is kind of, I talk about this in the book. And so what happened, you asked me what I've been doing during the pandemic, mm-hmm. and my marketing agency sat there like a dead boat. And I'm like, all right, well, I got to do something. So I went over and rescued all this stuff I've been teaching to 18-year-olds in college who didn't care. And I yanked it over to a podcast and a book about teaching adults, because I was watching everybody just flail and fail at persuasion and politics. And like, have no skills whatsoever. I'm like, I realized, like, America has no training in politics. Like, we've done it out of our peripheral vision forever, our back, you know, third, fourth battery in, energy. And now suddenly Trump broke everything and shoved it in everybody's face. It's like, oh, this stuff is harder than we thought.
Yeah.
So definitely. Like, you know, when you teach people some of that stuff and you're like, you get in and you start looking around, how can they get that confused? Yeah. And you start to see, oh, there's lots of things out there in the simulated media universe that are resetting the chessboard all the time and people just can't handle it.
I didn't want to get around to this, but we've talked about this before, but you know, one of my contemporaries, Scott Adams, I don't know if you've ever followed him on
I've
Twitter.
Listened to a little, he has a podcast, right?
Yes.
He has and he's lost it.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. He definitely, that happened a few years ago, but you know, he predicted that Trump would win. So, you know, okay. Yeah. You get that feather in your cap, you know, that's great. But he thinks Trump's this great persuader and that he's used these persuasion techniques. And you and I, a few years ago, talked about this a little bit. And that it's amazing and only Scott can see it. And that's why he knew that it was going to happen and all this other stuff. And I'm like, really? No, what Trump did is he just went further than anyone else and lied to you in such a big way that you thought to yourself, well, no, he wouldn't be lying to me.
Not this blatantly. We don't lie to this level.
No. And we don't. We've really never seen someone to that.
Politicians lie about a third, about the 25% mark. Maybe.
Yeah. Or maybe Andrew Johnson. Maybe you go back in the 19th century and there were probably some guys who were Trump-like. But, you know, we're not used to that level. It's like nuclear, you know, prevarication.
Yeah, well, I make the argument, and there's never going to be another Trump. Trump had 40 years as a promoter in New York.
Right.
Been a reality show star. He's had so much, you know, experience and training and all that stuff. He can actually pull off those lies. Did you see the quote today where the guy wrote down during a DOJ call with him that Trump just said, hey, just say that there's corruption and I'll take over from there. It's like, okay.
That's all I need you to do. I just need you to lie.
Back up the lie and get out of the way.
Get out of the way. That's right. Yeah. So we're not used to that. And it's taking a little bit. I think the country's slowly coming around a little bit, but there are a lot of people that are just, you know, my brother's one of them. It's like, you know, we didn't talk for like 6 or 7 months because what was it? Remember the one where Trump said, you know, we need to shine a light up your ass or drink bleach.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Kind of stuff. And he was like, he didn't say that. I said, no, he did say that. He said that right out loud. He said, but what he meant was someone had told him that there was some light thing you could do or that, you know, there was some disinfectant thing that you could do. And in his mind, disinfectant went to bleach. And then.
Yeah. It, right. But, you know, that's what you wanted to. Yeah.
You know, you're the persuasion guy. If you're having to go that far,
right?
Why would you trust
that guy if he can't even keep thoughts straight in his own head?
And Scott Adams says the same thing. He calls that's a hoax. That's a hoax. That's not what he said. That's not the same thing with the, you know, many fine people. You know.
Yeah.
No, he knew exactly what he was saying. He didn't want to piss off people who were going to vote for him.
Well, it's interesting, the whole, like I said, Trump was trained in promotion and then in, you know, entertainment, where you don't have the same restrictions on fact versus fiction. Like, fiction is fine in entertainment, and Trump is perfectly fine with fiction.
Yeah.
You know, and so when you see him pull that stuff over into politics, and like I said, rip politics open and be like, ah, look at this. Just like, open the pinata, man, because it's all spilled out. And so, yeah, nobody has training in it. It is interesting when I have people. I had a guy on who's at least says he used to be a hyper liberal, you know, peace protester and stuff like that. And now he's a big Scott Adams fan and used that exact thing about the fine people thing. And I'm like, well, let me step back with you a little and see if I can give you a meta context for what's happening to your head. And if I can get them over there, if they have enough, you know, emotional tolerance at this point to stay a little meta, then you can make some progress. But you go into the mosh pit with them.
Oh, no. You know, it's tribal, you know, we're, you know, It's yeah, you can't do it. But on the other hand, so Kim and I, my wife, we just went to a gay biracial wedding in Atlanta, of all places. And it was lovely and everything, had a great time, it was a whole deal. But what I told people was it was remarkable for not being remarkable. It was a wedding and it was right. Like a lot of other weddings and it was no big deal. And that gave me hope. It was like, well, this is fine. And there were some different kinds of people there. And, you know, they were fine. Everybody was fine.
Right. It's and mostly so I was familiarity, like, right? It's like, yeah. I lived in LA for 10 years. I've seen everything that has ever happened. I used to always come home from the improv and I would cut through Santa Monica on Santa Monica Boulevard. And there was a couple of gay leather bars, you know, there, and just the guys spilling out. I just was always so amused. I'm like, look at you guys. You are living the life.
I know. I did. There was a male gay couple there and having a great time. And this was late. I was pretty much in my cups as I can be. And I'm like, I'm just having a great time. I'm loving life. I'm going, what the fuck's going on in the world? This is great. Why can't everyone come to this thing? And I tapped the guy on the shoulder. He said, is this unusual? And he looked at me weird. Like he wasn't sure where I was coming from. And I said, no, I really, I'm having a great time. I think this is fantastic. And he goes, no, not that unusual anymore. I said, that's great. That's great. So sometimes I get, you get frustrated. You think it's us against them. And I had great conversations there with people from different, parts of the country, different political persuasions. And I really felt like we agreed more than we disagreed. Now, maybe it was because you're kind of forced into a kind of polite kind of thing. Sure. The anonymity of the internet is gone. You actually have to look people in the eye and talk about it. But most of us were like, didn't agree on everything, but that's okay. That's not going to happen. But it certainly wasn't like you're evil, and I'm evil and we can't ever have this conversation.
So you never really, in your career, you're not a political cartoonist and you don't really do political type work. You're more straight entertainment, right?
Yeah, I started as an editorial cartoonist back at University of Texas and Baylor.
Like hard hitting, like going after.
Yeah, it was pretty. Yeah, some stuff I have to remember. It was Reagan, and all that. Yeah, he's easy to make fun of, and that's what I wanted to do, and then I kind of realized that, I couldn't find a job. It was one of those things where, I don't know if you experienced this, there's like sort of the boomer wave demographics and you're kind of coming up a little at the end of that. Yep. You're a little younger than I am, and they kind of take all the slots. There are only so many slots. So it was hard to get a job. And so I ended up doing a political comic strip for the Houston Post called Scotty, which was about local politics. So I did that for 5 or 6 years.
Really?
For my first syndicated comic. Yeah, they paid me like $400 a week to do a daily local strip. There was like the only one in the nation.
And make fun of local politics. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah,
and it was, we had a female mayor back then. And we had, it was Houston. Houston's crazy. I mean, really.
Plenty of material to work with in Houston.
Yeah. It's like, that was a lot of fun. So, no, I have a lot. And in and over the hedge, we talked about the pandemic. We talk about anti-vaxxers. We do that, but we go back and forth. One second it's Hammy is creating new life in a blender, which is what he's doing today. And
as one
and
should, then if anything could do it, it's a blender.
Yes, yeah, of course. Yeah. So life is politics. It is. And so it's all, I just think it's a part of it. I mean, if you go out and you talk to your friends and you're doing that, that's just part of the, at least in my circle of friends, that's just part of the conversation.
Right.
And so,
but you never felt like a pull, like during the height of the Trump thing, like, hey man, I could throw some
Oh yeah, no, we did.
Into this.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't know how in early on in 2016, 2015, when he started to run, there were a lot of people who read Over the Hedge who were like, and it was starting to move into those two camps, and they were really upset with me. They were like, I really like this comic strip and I've been reading it for 20 years and I really think it's great. And how dare you have this opinion, you know?
Really?
Therefore, everything else that we've ever done is, you know, they were, it's not like that now. I think they've just all weeded themselves out. But
right.
But it was rough for a while, you know?
So like yeah. On what kind of strips? Like how directly were you going after this issue that they could identify it?
Well, just calling Trump a moron.
Oh, you know? There you go.
I
mean, yeah.
I was pretty blunt about it, or my character's calling him a moron. I can't think of anything. I do this every day. There are
sure,
so
sure.
Many.
God, isn't it crazy just the wash, the ocean of things you've created?
When I sit down to write it, I have no clue. It's like, and then I do it and it's like out of my head. And it's probably like Johnny Carson doing asking him to pick a monologue from 1977, you know, it's just another night. So.
Well, I've tracked jokes for the last, I don't know, 10 or 12 years since I started writing jokes on Twitter. I copy them. I write them first in a Google Doc, then copy them over into social uh-huh. media. So every year I'll count up how many I wrote.
Uh-huh.
You know, 'cause they're all collected right there. And it's sometimes, you know, almost 3,000 jokes.
And that's like, a lot.
Damn, that's a lot.
That's more than I'm only doing 356 comics. So, or no,
jokes,
we get two
one-offs, you know, you can burn through these. Just if I get bored, yeah. I write jokes.
Yeah.
So
but we've always
like
done
you,
it.
They don't want you to like intrude on their fantasy raccoon world.
No. It wasn't part of the movie, obviously. You know, they DreamWorks would never do that. But, you know, they knew what they were getting into, too. So they were fine with it. There was a lot of fun marketing meetings where they were trying to feel you out. Like, what do you really think of this movie? Like, they're really afraid we were going to go out and say, you know, like I was going to say horrible things about this immense capitalistic juggernaut.
And just bring it down.
Yeah, just get it done, get it out there. Hope there's not a terrorist attack, you know, something like that, like or a pandemic. Boy, I thought about that this year. If Over the Hedge had come out in the middle of this, it would just been heartbreaking. It just would have,
right? Yeah.
You know, it ended up on streaming somewhere, but you know,
like all the stars come together to make this incredible thing happen, and then nah.
No, we're not going to. But that didn't happen. It turned out fine. So anyway,
So what about your middle grade books? Do you have politics or social issues in those?
Well, you know, the stuff the kids deal with, like Odd Squad dealt with bullying and things like zero tolerance. And I have predictable opinions about zero tolerance and anything that's that simplistic.
Heroin,
yeah.
Kids.
Yeah. Heroin. Yeah, I tell kids don't do heroin in every one of my books. Actually, I'm going to do that. I'm going to have some character just say, "Don't do heroin."
Don't do heroin. Subtitled. Don't do heroin.
That's hilarious. It's stuff that what I try to do with the kids' books is, first of all, I want them to be about something. You know. Just, I don't care what it is. They're just something.
Like a cheese sandwich or whatever that thing was.
Yeah. Yeah. I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
What was the name of that book?
I won't go there.
Oh, the sloppy kid or whatever it was.
Yeah. Yeah. That guy.
Yeah.
The sloppy kid. No, those books are fine. One day he may blurb one of my books. And
I know. You got to play your authorial politics.
That's right. So, no, I just try to make them about something. And then, I try to make them that I want to put ordinary people. This is true about any kind of narrative fiction, whether they're movies or books or whatever. Try to put normal people in ridiculous or absurd situations. because that's funny. It's inherently funny to get somebody that you recognize or you recognize as yourself. And all of a sudden, the book I'm working on right now, it's called Starstruck. And like this boy band you love, they turn out to be aliens, you know, come to save the planet. You know.
I think you're right. I think they are aliens.
They could be. They could be.
Some of those, what's it, the South Korean guys? Like,
yeah, the BTS.
Oh my God, that stuff's so amazing to watch, but it looks like an alien rave.
They are. They it is a little robotic.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, in a good way.
No, I can watch that stuff and be like, wow, this took a lot.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. So that's one I'm working on with Bradley Jackson.
Bradley. What's Bradley up to?
Bradley just, you know, we're talking about this person that no one knows or cares about.
Bradley Jackson, he's a director writer out of Austin. He's done some comedy writing with Mike.
Yes. Anyway, he got his WGA cards writing a script for Imagine.
Oh, good for him.
Comedy. So
I connect with that guy. He has a mixed evaluation of me, but I should still grab
him. He's doing good. He's doing good. And he's so he's off. He's finally launched. You know,
it only took what?
Again, we're talking about someone no one cares about. I care about him, Bradley.
Sure they do. Sure they do. That's funny.
No, he's doing fine. And but yeah, we're doing this thing. But this will be, hopefully this will be interesting. It's been a tough sell over the last year. I've had two books that are still in kind of limbo. Because publishing just went off the rails, you know, around March or April last year, because it kicked everyone out of the offices. Almost the vast majority of editors are women, and a vast majority of those are moms, and they're just trying to get through the day. And so everything that used to take, you might hear back in 2 or 3 weeks, started to take 2 or 3 months and even longer. And it's like, unless you had a book that someone just had to have, and so there became a bidding thing, stuff just languished. And so we got some great feedback and got close a couple places, but then, you know, we kind of ran. And the other thing that's happened in publishing, which I maybe is interesting, you know, the whole George Floyd thing. And it's like everybody in entertainment who had known this forever decided, okay, now we're going to change. You know, like this is what it took. And it's not, I mean, it's not funny. It's a change that is long overdue. You know, there obviously should be more diversity and more diverse issues and stuff. But for whatever reason, that lit the fuse. And so the original thing of writing Starstruck, which is the book with the aliens and the boy band, it was two sisters, one older, one middle grade, you know, and who are, you know, like typical sisters fighting all the time and whatever. And, you know, and the younger one is like really into this because let's face it, 90-something% of the fans of these bands are young women. And so, but my agent, Dan, his name's Dan too. He's great. Hardest working man in show business. He said, I don't know, Mike, you know, things have changed and I think you should make this a guy. And I'm like, well, I don't think that'll fly. I don't think anyone will believe that. And he was like, no. This is exactly the kind of zigzag that you want to do. And I was like, both Bradley and I were like, no, we're not going to do that. And so we set it out and basically everyone turned it down and for various reasons, but one editor is still interested. And we've gone back and we're changing the lead character to a guy. And it's not like talk about a crazy dance to have to do.
Yeah.
It's like he's not, you know, nominally gay because you don't kind of deal with those subjects in the thing. He's just a guy who happened to like this band. And it comes in a particular moment in his emotional life and blah, 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 without getting into all the details. And it is better. It is more interesting. It is different.
Right.
But it took a lot. It took over a year for us to kind of pivot and go, it sucks. But I've almost done rewriting the first act. And I think it's going to be better. And I hope you know, I don't know what kids will think about it. That's a weird thing, because I always wonder, the editors are always second guessing, you know, this is, goes on in all of entertainment, but you know, it's, and you always, well, what's the audience going to think? And, you know,
people, I don't, you know, those are secondary to our taste.
I don't know the kids care that much. I think they care whether they're represented. And I think that's a fair critique. You know, if, you know, almost half of public school kids in the United States are people of color, then they probably should see themselves in the books, you know?
Yeah.
And
they
should see themselves in the books.
One of my marketing strands for this podcast is more white, middle-aged white guys than any other podcast. I've had 62 interviewees and 48 of them have been white, middle-aged white dudes.
We don't have anything else to do.
Right. I'm like, they're the ones that say yes to me.
Yes.
You know?
That's right. Wow, it's fun. You know, get this out there. But I want to, it's been a crazy last year and a half. It definitely has. And but it'll be all right. You know,
it's always, you know.
Yeah, I've gotten definitely, as I get older, I get more like, it's gotten easier. I think the sort of, you sort of don't care, you know, in a right way, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, you don't live and die with every unfair turn in the industry.
I used to do that. Yeah, you're going to make a mistake and whatever. And you just kind of do, I don't know. I'm going to be 62 in a week or 2 weeks. And I'm like, I do what I do, you know?
Right. Yeah. It's not going to veer much at this point.
No, it's not. I mean,
what was it? Do you remember what I said should be on your tombstone?
Oh God. What?
Remember I said it at one of your parties? I think Harry was saying something. And I was like, I don't know what the setup for it was, but the punchline was all that anxiety for nothing.
Yes. I think I was the one who said that.
No, I said it.
You said that. Okay.
But it is that kind of sense.
I thought I said that because people remind me of that all the time. You said that. I'll give you credit.
No, that's all right. You can keep your story. I don't need it.
Yeah, the worst thing for a comedian is like, you know, get your joke stolen, you know, all that anxiety for nothing. Yeah.
But it's that sense of, you know, I think I see, like, I'm pitching a show next week to a production company out of LA because I want to start this thing called Comedy Accelerator, because I've always done work with young comics and things like this, and it always ends badly. Like, there's been like three times when it's gone really, really well. But comics are really hard to work with. And I was just saying, like, here in Austin, they've had all this infusion of new comics because of Joe Rogan moving here. And he brought a whole, you know, comet tail of comics with him who are going to get here and realize they can't make any money in Austin and be like, what? But I'm like, what they need to learn to do is, like, you can make money, like, as a joke writer in a lot of different ways. I can make money on Fiverr, punching up. I used to do that as like a little side thing, mostly for fun because it pays so little, but I punched up like a pickpockets act in London, you know, all sorts of best men toasts. Like, it's just crazy, but you make 100, 150 bucks here and there. And I'm like, why aren't you guys doing some of that? Learning some writing skills, you know, get a writer's packet together through some of this stuff. So it's that sense of people starting their career, not wanting to listen to us at the end of our careers going, hey, you know, there's probably a better path through.
Oh no, I would have been, you know, there was this stuff. Yeah. I mean, there are a few, not too many regrets, but a few big ones where I should have gone here and done this thing. And, you know, I had some asinine idea about it that didn't make it's embarrassing. I'm not even going to talk about it, and I turned down a chance to work on something that turned out to be big, and, you know.
But you also turned down chances to work on things that turned out to be nothing, right?
Yeah. I've worked on many things that turn out. That's the thing. I think, guys, there's two things in particular that I would tell anyone who's business and entertainment or even the arts is that first of all, it is not, you're going to have a big break, and this is just going to keep going. It's just going to, no, that's not how it works. I don't know anyone there. I'm sure there's a few people who kind of got that thing, and
just few success actors, from success few, to success.
Yeah. But most everyone I know, it's just this. And you know, if you're paying attention, the peaks get a little higher and a little higher, but you're going to go down. And so my first word of advice is save your fucking money. As I sit here still paying off my kids' college loans.
Yeah, when you're on the peak, make sure you get enough snow.
Yes. But that's really hard to do psychologically, because you're sort of betting against yourself. You're sort of saying, well, this could end anytime. And that's like that voice in your head that, fortunately, it wasn't my parents, but some people saying, no, this is never going to work. And so you don't want to give into that. And so you're like, no, I'm going to pretend this is just going to, and I say that understanding how difficult it is to do.
And well, it's not an unreasonable thought to think, hey, I've worked really hard. I've gotten to a point where I'm good enough at this, that this will probably continue at least within a range. You don't expect the bottom to drop out for 2 years the way it does, you know, in entertainment, that the whole industry suddenly shifts away. Like you're saying, like suddenly nobody wants a middle-aged white guy comedy writer anymore. It's like, no, like even if you're funny, we get it. But man, we're taking in some political hits by hiring you. It's like, that is not my, I'm just a dude who writes jokes.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah, no. But the bottom does drop out but then you come back and it, you know,
well, even the big
they're always, players, you know, they're always predatory lenders willing to bail you out for a little while.
that's why they call them predatory lenders.
That's right.
So, that's cool. So tell me about some of the book writing, like the difference in that and versus the comic stripping, because you made a big pivot over into books.
Well, I didn't. I really didn't have a choice, because one of the bottoms that dropped out was newspapers and newspaper syndicated comics. And Hedge is still around, but it went from a peak of maybe 200 papers now to, I don't even look, but it's like 80, maybe 70. It's not a lot of money, in other words. And so I had to find something else to do. And fortunately, there was a few guys that were pivoting. My agent, Dan Lazar, was kind of looking for those of us who were, you know, successful, experienced cartoonists to do these, you know, kid books. And, you know, Diary of a Wimpy Kid became so popular. And so there was this hybrid thing of sort of some text and some drawings and stuff. And it became very popular. And so, you know, I was fortunate and, did Odd Squad, and Disney picked it up, and it was a great deal. And new news is, you know, it was a great deal. I got paid very well, and then it did okay, but it didn't do as well as, you know, I didn't make back my advance. But the guy who was head of sales for Disney had moved on to another company, who is the largest distributor of books in non-bookstores, so like Walmart and Target and grocery stores, wherever you find books, not in a bookstore. And he loved it so much, they're going to bring it back with a new title, new covers, and everything, sort of like almost 10 years later.
Wow.
And so that's cool.
Yeah.
That's another lesson for you young people is it is really about content at the end of the day. And if the stuff is really good, that, you know, it'll find a, you know, cream rises to the top. You'll find a place to, you know, it'll find a home, because people, you know, it's good.
Well, and the content monster is always hungry, right? I had a manager for a little while out in LA who had the rights to the Neil Armstrong story from somebody's angle or whatever. And he'd had it forever and pitched it forever. Nobody wanted it. And then suddenly I look up and go, oh, look, there's a miniseries about Neil Armstrong. And it was his. You know, he just had it. He had the rights to it, kept the rights to it, and just pitched it for 10 years until somebody's like, you know, we're really hurting for content. And the right stuff came out, and there's a, you know, this whole NASA resurgence. Let's buy this thing. There you go.
No, there were like two Neil Armstrong movies. And then there were, yeah, the Everything comes around, and that's why with this whole thing with the pendulum is swung right now. You know, at the end of the day, a bit of advice is that, you know, we work for these very large corporations who are in the business of making money, and that's what they care about. That's really all they care about.
Oh man, that's so disheartening.
It is. But you know, and if you can deliver the goods, you know, if it's something that people want, then you'll be fine.
All right, I got a middle-aged pitch for you. You ready?
Okay.
You ready? You know what's coming. So it's kids that died in the 1918 flu. You know, the Spanish flu, and half were vaxxers and half were unvaxxers. And they come back as ghosts to haunt the kids now into getting vaxxed or unvaxxed. What do you think?
I think that's an SNL skit. Which would require a setup, I think.
Yeah. Oh, well, I would read that book.
Yeah.
No. A little street urchin from Philadelphia 1918.
Get the vaccination. Please, sir.
So if you could rearrange your career a little bit, like, what would you do? Would you have ended up in kids books like this, or would you have trended more towards kind of adult, like you like talking politics and social issues? Would that, if you could have made that a career, like, are there guys that have a career in that? You're like, you know, I would have liked
Yeah, that's an interesting, because they say, you know, if the thing that you spend most of your time doing or reading about or whatever is probably the thing that you should be doing.
Right.
And yeah, I spent a lot of time. If you looked at my Twitter following and all that, it's, you know, it's probably mostly politics and stuff like that. I'm not a super social person either. So I don't think it's an accident. I work at home by myself, you know?
Yeah.
So,
yeah. See this?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
I'm at a 2-bedroom house by myself.
Right. And I just, so I would, you know, very early on, you looked at that kind of Doonesbury kind of scenario and you went, this is, especially you're an undergraduate and you're going, well, this is pretty cool.
Yeah. You know, yeah. Oh, yeah. For sure. He's in the conversation.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm like, well, my joke is, well, he couldn't draw, neither can I. So that should hold me back.
Good line.
So, you know, so I just thought that would be the coolest thing, you know, to just get paid for that. And over the years, occasionally I have been.
It's not weird though. Like, I never did politics, and even when I did stand up and stuff, I never really did politics. I have
really. I'm surprised.
It's just too much work. Like, it's too much effort to do that in clubs.
Was it because you feel like you're alienating half your audience?
No, I could care less about alienating people. What I cared about was the alienated making my life hell during the show.
Oh, like,
it's just too much work to deal with them.
Oh, because you're going to get some drunk in the back who's going to.
Yeah. And so, like, if you read my Twitter, oh my God, you know, it's constantly politics and going for hard punch to the throat and everything else. And so that's fine. But I curate my feed there. I don't let anybody troll me or heckle me there either, because I just don't like to deal with people's stupidity.
Yeah.
But, you know, I do like that stuff. And once, like I said, once Trump appeared and it's like, ruined politics with entertainment, and I'm like, oh, I know both these games. I'll get in there and, you know, I can talk this stuff.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if life
like this, like in a podcast format, I'm cool with it. Having a discussion is great. Say whatever you want.
Yeah, no, I enjoy that too. In fact, I miss it, because it's the kind of thing you did when I did when I'm younger, and you're kind of your social group kind of shrinks over the years, and you already know what everybody thinks. And so it's hard to get a rise out of anybody, you know.
Funny.
And you tend to hang out with people you agree with. So
yeah, I'm interviewing Pat Hazel next week. So
I talked to Pat a couple times during the pandemic. And
missed the good old Austin good. Film Festival bar days, me, you, and Pat.
He seems to be doing his shows are starting to come back up. You know,
the little Americana
things. Yeah,
small theater stuff he does.
Yeah. And so he's, you know, did you see, here's somebody else. Nobody knows who we're talking about, but he had a pilot for a sitcom in the 90s. Have you ever seen it?
Pat?
Yeah.
I think I did. Like he was starring in it, right?
Star. He's a star in it. It's pretty good. I mean, I can
That's the perfect description of Pat. It's pretty good. Like people meet him and like,
Pat. I didn't mean it like that. But it was good. I mean, I think it got on TV in like as a summer, during the summer reruns thing or whatever for a couple of episodes. But
I'm going to tell him you said that about him next week.
Yeah, I know.
That he's pretty good.
Yeah. That's the problem of coming out of my cave and talking to people. Someone might listen. But it was fun. It was a little, you know, I don't know how to describe it, but it had that old fashioned rhythms.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't see, you know, they don't really do it like that anymore. I guess
that's why he's so good at writing like the Little Americana, the Wonder Bread years and things like that. Wonder. He's just a really good joke writer and, you know, he's not going to hurt anybody's feelings. And
if anything, I would have said it was probably not. It did lack a little edge.
Yeah,
and that was like probably the time in the early 90s when you probably needed a little edge, something.
Yeah, it was starting to go that way. It was starting to get, like the whole.
Now it's completely shifted. Have you seen Ted Lasso?
I've seen ads for it. I haven't watched it.
Oh, you got to watch it. It's so good. Oh, I.
Like good in what way?
It looks like something you've seen before, right? It's the spurned wife of the owner of a soccer team inherits the team in a divorce, and she wants to get back at the husband. So what's she gonna do to the team? She hires an American football coach to come and who's never coached soccer to coach.
Hey, fish out of water. I like it.
I know, and it's like, we've all seen that movie. It's like Major League. It has that plot, and there's like, it's so obvious on the surface, and then you watch it, and it's nothing like that. Huh, it's nothing like that, and it takes that expectation and it completely flips it, and the main character, Sudeikis, is so good in the role, and he's so charming. And he just, you know, they keep throwing shit at him. You know, I mean, he goes in the local pub and they just chant wanker at him. That's like a whole scene.
It happens to me when I go into pubs. That's weird. They took that from my life.
Yeah. And then, you know, he's resilient and he's a good guy and he wins in the end.
Of course. Well, I'll check that out.
It's good.
You've lived at the center of trying to get from old formats like flat, you know, newspaper comic strips into all this new formatting stuff. Like we talked, you know, even just like the little the podcast now resurging, like you were at the beginning of podcasts and then it couldn't figure its way. And now it's starting to figure a way into the consciousness of the world. And comics, you did that. And then with Ringtails, trying to get that into an animated, you know, short format that could make that transition. Talk about some of that. Cause you were in the middle of that.
So my partner and I, Jim Cox, we did a thing starting like 2005, I guess, when things were starting to come back after the crash back in the late 90s and the internet was starting to, there was, you know, money floating around. And we had this idea to get the rights to print comics and animate them. So we got the rights to like New Yorker cartoons, Dilbert, and Over the Hedge eventually. And they were, you know, in terms of getting them on the internet and getting people to watch them, they were really popular. We were at the beginning of the podcast era, Dilbert for a while was the number one podcast. And it was just all it was these little 30-second animations stacked up against each other. People loved it. And we're like, but we could not, there wasn't an advertising thing for it.
Right. Then.
It just, you can't put a 15 or 20 second ad on a 15 or 20 second piece of content.
Tell CNN and SPN that.
Well, they do now. I mean, Jesus,
it's awful. I'm so pissed off when
watch the Olympics now. The Olympics just keep going, and then they put up a commercial, and you know,
I'm curious as to what the research is on that, like whether that's.
Yeah, and the same in baseball games now. Just this year,
golf does that too.
Giants too. Yeah, they're, you know, it's usually just in between pitches and stuff, but it's annoying anyway. So we did Ringtails and now podcasts are kind of the new radio, and they're attracting big money and big audiences. And I think it's still a little niche-y, but it's big enough if you have a couple hundred thousand, you know, regular listeners that you can make some money.
Yeah. And I think the thing is, what interests me is, you know, as a communication scholar, academic, which I was never very good at, but I've always been an intellectual in that area. And I love it to look at it, like understanding a really good, like even overhearing a really good conversation is super stimulating.
Yeah.
As long as it's a really good conversation, but if it drops down a little bit, like the boredom that's, you know, available and two boring people talking, oh my God, it's awful.
Yeah.
But I think podcasts are starting to figure that out a little bit, you know, produce it a little bit more, make sure that, like you said, there's activation in it, conflict, whatever you want, but.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of them, we were talking about Scott Adams early on, and also, what's his name again, who just moved here?
Rogan.
Yeah. I mean, they're hot take, you know, thing. They're going to. You know, it's all about saying something controversial. You know, I mean, you know, Clay Travis is online. He's a sports guy out of Nashville, has his own sports empire. Now, maybe your listeners know he's the same thing. And saying a lot of stuff that it just gets a rile out of people. And
that's Trump, that's reality politics.
My problem with it is it's ultimately bad faith, because I kind of feel like these people don't really think that. I think they just know that this gets clicks and gets people to listen and gets people to do that. I mean, you always want whatever it is you're doing to be interesting, but I don't think you have to lie to people to be interesting. And I don't think you have to manipulate people, you know?
Yeah. So I think Scott Adams thing,
I feel like he's not into persuasion. He's into manipulation. I think those, you can speak to this, but those are two different things, right? Or aren't they?
Manipulation is just unethical persuasion.
Oh, okay.
It's a form of persuasion, but I like the tagline to my brand is ethical, the power of ethical only persuasion.
Right.
Because I'm like, you don't have to use that. To me, it's clumsy and it has too much residual loss in it, because the people who know you're lying now discredit you forever and will never do anything.
Yeah. I mean, there's a thing. I mean, I'll give it to Scott. He's kind of expert at walking up to the line without going over it, and kind of doing a lot of that just asking questions thing. You know, that Tucker Carlson deal.
Again, where, I would.
Yeah. You know,
when I'm around those guys, like I typically don't use full like rhetorician buzzsaw on them, but I would shred him like a bad cabbage, man. It would be ugly.
You should go in there, because he does have, there are a few people get in his head and it's fun to watch, but you have to, it would take some effort. I don't think it's worth it.
Well, and that's the whole thing. Like I'm not really here to, if I were doing this, and maybe it'll get this point where I was doing this to try to make money, then I would want to go up against guys like that, because it's not really healthy for the society to leave those guys unchallenged.
Yeah.
The reason why they have such power is because they get to exist in a monologued universe that they control.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anybody with any decent skills got into dialogue with them would make them look like fucking idiots and liars and all that stuff.
Do you want to pause it so I can let my dog in the house?
Sure, man.
All right.
I was going to let it go, because those are the moments, right? It's like, oh man, that guy's cat just came into the podcast. That's when it got really cool.
No, he was just being annoying. He's going back to the bedroom. This is great. I enjoy, you know, talking about my favorite subject.
your career and the height that it's.
That's right. No, it's my so-called career.
It is fascinating. Like when I look at what's happened with, and again, people like trying to figure out something like Scott Adams and the right and what's happened to the media world and how that storm has become so strong, you know, and you look at what, like the things you've done, which take a traditional strip, has a massive history in newspapers. People know what that is. It's this during the week and this on Sundays. They get color on Sundays and longer. People know what it is for 75 years, right?
100 years. Yeah.
100 years.
Yeah.
Suddenly the technology shifts and man, like look what's happened to just like memeing. And I mean, that's comic strips, right?
Yeah. No, there's a lot of what happened to comic strips is they lost their context. You know, when you used to get a newspaper, most people used to get it up until the 70s or 80s. And some people would get two, one in the morning and one in the evening. And you'd have your news and you'd have your sports and you'd have the comics. And it was part of,
within a world.
Yeah, exactly. And so when you take the comics out of that context, they're not, except for very few of them, and I'm not including Over the Hedge in that. They're just not that, they're not compelling enough for you to go search for them on the internet. You know, I have thought about if somebody like Facebook or Twitter or Instagram or something like that, you know, bought rights to them and put them up so they showed up in your feed, that would be a way of putting them in a context. But I don't, you know, they wouldn't do that unless they felt like that was, you know, they could run some advertising against it or, you know, I don't know. I've had a million ideas about how, like putting it in a kind of frame of ads around it. But the problem is those are just display ads and those are kind of useless. So, you know, I don't know. That's what we thought with Ringtails was we could sort of come up with that, a way to take the comic and animate it and give it a way so it could be, you know, brought to you by so-and-so. But,
right.
You know,
but that was like, you're trying to predict into the new media world, which has no, like the old logics don't work. Like I think you've described it perfectly. The newspaper is a series of experiences. It's, drama and sports excitement. And then some comic relief.
Right.
You know, and then some astrology for your supernaturalism, whatever.
Right. And then the want ads. That was a big part of it. That's really what really drove the stake in the heart of newspapers was when Craigslist came, you know, because they made a lot of money on those things and then they completely went away. And so.
Well, and that's the phrase right there. It completely went away. That's changed everything. Like it's always completely going away. Like,
yeah, no, they're still there. And it's like they talked about how books were going to, you know, with the Kindle and all that. It's, you know, I'm pretty safe because you're not going to buy your 9 or 8 year old a Kindle, you know, generally, unless it gets down to $5 or something, you know, then because they're going to, you know, drop it in the toilet. And
that's interesting. I didn't think about that. Yeah, you do have a built-in bulwark.
So my earnings from ebooks have always been around 5% or whatever. People buy them. I think it's weird, but
right,
you know, like that. And audiobooks of my books, that's weird. Because they give you a CD or whatever to go along with it so you can see the pictures. And it does it like a beep, like those old fashioned slide things we saw when we were in school, you know, beep, go to the next slide.
That's hilarious. Yeah, it all gets mixed together and then people look and go, well, again, like the rise of the right. I'm like, yeah, look, there's no guardrails on any of this stuff. Like you can, they are telling supernatural fiction stories. Like the other day I saw a meme of Obama carrying pizza boxes and the, you know, the thing was, you know, he and his husband kept kids underneath the White House, you know, to drink their blood. And I'm like, I don't, you know, I'd almost watch that movie. That sounds pretty, sounds like a pretty good villain.
Yeah, no, they are. They're like that pizza place in Washington, D.C., you know, that absolutely didn't have a basement, but in the thing had a basement. And yeah, I mean, it's all fun and games till the guy shows up with a, you know.
Sure, but that's the thing. People can't tell the difference in these simulated stories, these fictional stories, and reality anymore, especially people that are having mental issues. So, you know, like the right is telling much more intense stories. I got to give them that.
Yeah, no, no. I mean, they know how to gather a crowd, you know, and to do it. And again, it's just, it's so crazy that, I mean, I just before we got on here, there I was watching MSNBC and they're doing a story with these four nurses, you know, who refused to get vaccinated in North Carolina. And I'm like, you went through all that school, you went through that, you work with doctors, you're in the healthcare thing, and you really, really believe in all this nonsense about, oh, it hasn't been tested enough. Well, actually, it's been tested in the United States on 150 million people. No one has died as a result of a vaccine. There have been a few incidences, you know, people always have some reaction, but I mean, I'm like it's more important to them, I don't know, to believe in the fiction, you know, than it is to try to figure out, you know, what's true and what isn't. And it, or it becomes this thing of, you know, if I do that, then I'm betraying something, somebody. Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of that too, right? Like there's a story about, I think maybe it was Arkansas or Mississippi, Tennessee, doesn't really matter, where people were dressing up as somebody else, like
to get the vaccine. Yeah.
I
saw a story the other day about where the doc said, yeah, the people come in and say, okay, you can't tell anybody, you know. I did this.
All that community blowback is real, though. I mean, that's a real thing.
Yeah, no, it is
down there.
I know.
Those are clannish cultures. That's what they started from. They're still very much in group, you know, follow the dictates of the community. It's very strong. And so I can see why that's part of it. But it's also like, I don't know how much sort of hyper modern media theory you've read into, but there's this great single word that I use with, again, when I'm trying to get the right that are thinkers into a higher meta level. Mm-hmm. And it's the word simulacrum, which comes from Jean Baudrillard, French theorist. And he basically said that what is going to happen in the media age, when it becomes like this, when it's so good and so produced and everything else, is that it'll outpace reality and people will use this as their baseline for experience, kids coming up through it, and then reality seems weird. And so you start living in a simulacrum and the foundations go away for truth. Because now it's just, does it look good? Does it seem interesting? Those become the anchors for truth. And that's what happens once you watch too much Fox News or whatever, with all their stings and their music and all the stuff that they're doing to force you into the simulacrum.
Yeah, you watch Laura Ingraham and there's a smarmy kind of, you know, Tucker Carlson's the same way. It's like the attitude is, how can you possibly not believe what I'm saying? I don't know how they quite do that. They practice in the mirror or they do. It's
repulsion. Like if you look at the emotions that they use, it's a lot of derision and repulsion. It's like, they are trying to tell us
what to do.
And it's so saturated that this is what happens to the people on the right and the left too, like especially millennials, they get over triggered.
Yeah.
That they see things that are like, how many horror films have you seen masquerading as documentaries about meat? I mean, they literally shoot them like horror films. It's like it's dark and grainy and black and white, and this cow collapses, and you're like, well, shit, I don't want to eat that.
No, no.
But you know, the right uses that stuff in TV and it hyper triggers the hypothalamus into disgust and repulsion. That's
what's funny, and you're saying that it's the right is generally not entirely, but more emotionally triggered than I think most of the left. I think extreme parts of the left, there is that same thing, but that's the whole circle thing. They end up at the same place. But it is how much they are, how emotionally it goes. And I remember, you know, because I grew up, I told you about this, you know, my father was like this Ayn Rand objectivist thing. And so I grew up with that kind of, it was kind of a, it's sort of a, it's sort of like Scientology, except it's maybe stupider.
Less aliens showing up.
Yeah, there aren't as many aliens. But anyway, that, so I got a good grounding in that early on. And I didn't realize at the time, because it masquerades as philosophy and as, you know, rational debate, that it is very emotional. You know, it is, it's saying, you know, it presents a very simplistic world. It's a lot like religion. And it says, you know, if you do these seven things, everything's going to be fine. And that's all you need to know. And it's like today, we were, before we were coming on, we were talking about, and this goes to definitely goes to rhetoric, you know, the CDC stuff that came out, you know, they're having a horrible time with their messaging. And I don't know how much of that's the White House and whether I tend to default that people are not very well organized generally, no matter who's in charge. And so there's not a lot of back and forth. People tend to assume it's more organized than it is. But so what's the better, this is a good question for you. What's the better message? You know, wear a mask, don't die. Okay, simple, direct, whatever. Or, okay, here's what we've got. This is the chart over here. And you take 20 minutes to explain all of the things. And I'm like, I know why they do the first one, because you're going to tune out. But on the other hand, if they do the second one, they don't have to go back and say later on, and when you say, but you said, you know, you go, no, I didn't say that. I said, like, the thing right now is people are saying, on the right are saying, hey, you know, you said get vaccinated, I wouldn't have to wear a mask, and I wouldn't get the virus. Well, no, that's not exactly what people said. Well, it's kind of what some people said, but really what the vaccine is not a force field. It's just not going to keep the virus out of your upper respiratory system. It's going to come in, your body's going to recognize it, and it's going to fight back if you've got the vaccine. And for the vast majority of people, you won't even know about it. It'll go away, and a few people will get sick. So what's a better message? That one or the, you know, if you want to get the most numbers, this is like the Dr. Fauci thing at the very beginning of the pandemic, when he said, no, it's, you know, it's a waste of time to wear masks. And I think but what he was saying, he's worried that all the entire mask inventory in the United States was going to get eaten up.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the problems, I mean, these are very, again, very complicated situations, which require sophisticated communicators. Yes. And that's not what they've got. Medical is the worst, because it's the doctors coming out with stuff. Fauci should not be talking in public. You know, really? he's a great epidemiologist or whatever, virologist. He's done it forever, but that doesn't make him a politician. He got into the political wash with one of the most attack oriented politicians in history, and they're still chewing him up.
Yeah.
You know, and he's not a politician. He's a decent, ordinary communicator, but he's not, you know, the, like, Psaki or whatever her name is.
The secretary.
He's not a professional communicator. Right. You need people that have those skills that can come out. The problem is that they didn't, you know, and technically from a rhetoric perspective, is they didn't use their qualifiers correctly. They didn't heighten and amplify their qualifiers and say, look, the safest thing you can do right now is wear a mask.
Yes.
Now, it's not perfect. It doesn't matter. This is the safest thing you can do. That's well qualified. It's clear, period. Then later on, they can say, hey, we think right now I have to get the vaccine, but they're not highlighting the qualifier. So it's getting lost. And then people are accusing them of, you know, wishy-washy and all that.
Yeah.
But it's just communication sophistication, and you super complicated situation and bad communicators. So there you go.
They need to hire you. Definitely.
Everybody clearly needs to hire me, because I will straighten it all out.
No, I mean, that makes perfect sense to me. It's like you say you're honest and straightforward, but you qualify it. You say, look, this is our best advice. And I think they try to say that, you know, but they, what they don't want to say, for right now, this is my, because it implies that it could get worse.
Yeah, but I mean, if you're using qualifiers correctly, you can retain all of your credibility, all your authority. Yeah. and you can save it later on, because that's what they're giving away, is claiming too much unqualified authority in a constantly moving situation.
Right. But, and there's just too much about this. It's moving too quickly, and there's a tendency human beings to think that we can control this thing. You know, and there's a great New York Times story today talking about how, you know, when the Delta variant came up, it came and it blew through India, but then it went away. Why did it go away? They don't really know.
Right.
It wasn't really because a lot of people got vaccinated. It certainly didn't happen in India. It wasn't because a lot of people socially distanced or wore masks or whatever. Now, maybe there was some mitigating. People got freaked out and stayed home. I don't know. Same thing in Great Britain. It's coming down. It went through there. Is that going to happen here? They're saying,
well, we don't even know what a virus is.
I know. Is it alive? No. Maybe.
It's insane. It replicates, but it doesn't eat.
And what's its purpose? That's something I've looked up online. They think maybe that some of the, over the, you know, millions of years, some bits of it have helped. Because there's got to be an evolutionary use for a virus, right?
Or the virus, not necessarily. I mean, like, all evolution says is that whatever adapts fastest is going to survive. Right. And so the virus is like, great, you know, I can survive. Watch me evolve and mutate.
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know. It's a crazy situation. But again, like, so one of the other books I'm working on as a sub book of my first book is Why America Can't Think. And just show you, like, I can do a basic logic training with stuff like qualifiers. Those are logic tools. And if you get trained to use them correctly, then you become viable in those situations. Even in difficult arguments with crazy people, it doesn't matter. Your qualifiers still work. But you got to have them down. Like, you can't half-ass it. You've got to be ready in those environments. And so nobody's getting that level of training, communication training. And so we just flail, and then everybody gets upset and it's like, yeah, this is just a mess. As I call it, sometimes it's a hurricane hitting a ping pong.
There are people like Tucker Carlson who use their skills for evil. You know, they are good communicators. They're just,
those guys are amazing.
Doing it in bad faith. And, you know, because they're getting paid $20 or $30 million a year.
Yeah, but he's sitting in a studio with writers and directors and producers and everything else. So he's not that. He couldn't do that on his own.
You don't think so?
No.
You don't think he's driving that train?
No. He's not. He's talented. He's good on camera, but that's just a guy who's good on camera. I worked with plenty of people in LA that were great on camera, and you get them off camera, they had nothing to say. Yeah. You know, take the script out of their mouths and they're like, like, yeah, that would be much more fun to just watch Tucker Carlson do a debate, like a live debate that wasn't scripted. Well,
he used to be on CNN and MSNBC, and he used to show up on those sorts of things, and he wasn't quite as nutty as he is now. And you know, he was always conservative, but I don't know. I think
they're actors running to the script. Here's the script that works. Fuck, they'll say anything. It doesn't make any difference. So that's what actors are soulless people, and we all know that. So, well, cool, man. This was super fun. We're up over an hour.
I hope it's interesting.
No, you're great. I knew you'd be great at this. You're always fun to talk to, and you've got a flashy background and living the life in your castle. Well, and the creative life, man. It's the stairway to heaven.
Nope. I think a creative career is great. I think it is, but it's not for everybody.
Well, thanks, man. We'll jump on again sometime. It's super fun.
Yeah, no, it's good to talk to you. Let's get together as soon as it's safe.
As soon as the next variant rolls through and takes out another swath of people, we'll do that.
Okay.
All right. This has been Mike Fry. Like, go to Mike Fry's website, buy his books.
You can Google me. I'm everywhere.
He's everywhere. Like, follow his Twitter. It's always great to see stuff pop up from an Instagram from over the hedge.
Yeah.
Good stuff, man. So get out there, persuade some people. They need it. I'll see you next time.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.